Now, the second one, in a similar way, has to do with the word contemplation. I said the title of this talk is noetic, is Dimensions of Noetic Prayer, and noetic is an adjective that comes from noesis. The word nous is associated with it, and sometimes it's translated as contemplative, but contemplation, or it means contemplative. But theoria is the actual Greek word for contemplation. Again, you have something that is very distinctly understood by this tradition of prayer that I'm speaking of. It's unique, and again, and the only way to describe it is to show you the difference between the I don't necessarily want to say the Western idea of contemplation or contemplative prayer and the Eastern or Orthodox. It's more like the idea of contemplative prayer that is understood generally in the world today, and the idea of contemplation and contemplative prayer that is understood in Orthodoxy, and in particular by the great masters of spiritual prayer. In the West, or in this, the general idea of the Christian understanding of contemplative prayer, not Orthodox, the idea of contemplative is usually distinguished with the idea of active. And so you have people who are inclined toward the active life, and then you have people who are inclined toward the contemplative life. And you have religious orders that are involved in the active life, missionary work, schools, all sorts of activities. And that's called the active religious orders of communities. And then you have the religious orders that are usually called contemplative. And as a matter of fact, there is even a general understanding that a person can be psychologically contemplative. In other words, you have tests. You have psychological tests to indicate to you whether you are an active person or a contemplative person, and whether you should be involved in an active order, or whether you should be involved in some kind of spirituality that is contemplative, or whether you should be involved in some kind of spirituality that is active. Now, this is not the way the Orthodox philokalic tradition understands the word contemplation or contemplative prayer. I'm not judging it. I'm simply saying that the understanding is different. If you come to it with that understanding, you will not understand what I'm saying, or you will not understand what the fathers of the philokalia or the great masters of prayer are saying when they talk about contemplation and contemplative prayer. It all goes back to prayer as the gateway to contemplation. In the Orthodox philokalic tradition, contemplation is something that occurs when one reaches close to the state of dispassion. And that's why in St. John of the Ladder, that after simplicity or meekness, after humility, after discernment, after stillness, fundamental, there comes then prayer. The 28th step is prayer. The 29th step, the step before the last, is dispassion. That is our goal in prayer. Our goal in prayer is dispassionateness, non-enslavement to the passions, praying before God in which the passions do not arise. That is our ultimate goal. And then the last step, of course, is love or charity. So the steps upward, simplicity and humility, discernment, stillness, prayer, dispassion, and love. So you can see that is fundamental to the gate of contemplation. Prayer is the gate to contemplation, but prayer has to be pure in order for that gate to open. And dispassion is the means. Now, it really puts prayer, the attainment of prayer, on a very high level. On a very high level. And I am deliberately focusing on this because it's important to realize what prayer can, where it can go, and where you can reach, how you can reach prayer. Our prayer doesn't take off, doesn't have wings, because we don't expect it to have wings. We don't expect to take wing and rise up to God in prayer. So our attitude to prayer must change. It doesn't mean that we should deceive ourselves, and this is I'll come to this about our state. It means that when we enter the church and when we are actually seeking to pray to God, we really want to see His face. We want to see God's face. And if we don't want to see God's face, we should know that, right? If we don't want to see God's face, that's the first thing we should know. What is it about my inner attitude that when I think about seeing God's face, I hide? And if you are hiding, then you are doing exactly what Adam and Eve did in the garden when God came looking for them in the quiet of the evening. But it's important to know that, because the knowing of that can liberate you. If you cloud it over, or if you cover it over with something else, then underneath your efforts, your outer efforts that you are conscious of as you think of yourself praying, as you look at your self-image praying, all of those outer efforts will be useless, because underneath it there will be an attitude and an approach that is undermining everything you're doing, and you won't get near to God. But the prayer is getting near to God. That's what it's about. And that's why contemplation is put on a very high level. You just can't sit down for 15 minutes and use some kind of word to 15 minutes a day, morning and night, use some kind of word to draw your attention to think that you're going to experience contemplation. It doesn't happen. It simply doesn't happen. Well, something may happen, but it won't be contemplation, at least according to this tradition. It won't be contemplation. As a matter of fact, the great fathers of the church are very careful, very clear in saying that you should not actually seek for contemplative gifts and joys while you are still in an impassioned state. And here's one other distinct thing. We talked about that about theory and practice, about, you know, when you don't have the practice, and you go to the theory. Well, so there's really no escape there, because in the Orthodox tradition, they turn the relationship of practice to theory around, especially in the life of prayer. What do I mean by this? I mean, normally, you have a theoretical idea first. You have ideas about what you want to do first, and then you put them into practice, right? That's true in science, it's true in business, it's true in almost every approach. So theory really comes before practice. So there's theory, then you kind of work out your theory, and then you have practice, whatever it might be. In this spirituality of orthodoxy, in this orthodox idea of prayer, that idea is completely turned around. Practice comes before theoria. Theoria, the word theory, what our word theory comes from the word theoria, which means contemplation. But the word theory no longer means contemplation. It means an abstract mentalization about concepts and ideas that is not connected with reality yet. Because it's practice that connects it to reality, right? But in the Orthodox tradition, theoria is the experience of the reality. So the practice comes first. And it's very clear in the tradition as to how the practice comes first. In this tradition that leads from Evagrius and Macarius through Diodocus of 43, through Dionysius the Areopagite, through Maximus the Confessor, through St. John of the Latter, through Hesychius of Jerusalem, through Simeon the New Theologian, through Gregory Palamas, down to our day, through Theophan the Recluse, and the great elders and saints of our day, they understand that there's a threefold stage of spiritual growth, and it's called praxis, theoria, or gnosis, and theologia, which is to say, purification. The praxis is purification, and the gnosis is illumination, the illumination of your being, and the theologia, what's called theologia, is not theology as a study, but it is union with God. Union with God is called theologia in this tradition. Theology, theologia is called union with God. Now that tradition, the idea of the threefold path exists in both the East and the West. The idea of purgation, illumination, realization exists both in the East and the West. You'll find it in St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, and in particular in the Rhineland mystics, who are probably the closest ones to the Orthodox tradition, like Meister Eckhart. But that's an aside. It exists in all of those traditions, in both sides of the tradition. But in Orthodoxy, the practice has never been lost. The understanding has never been lost. It's always been transmitted. As Metropolitan Callistos used to say, there's really a twofold apostolic succession, right? There's the apostolic succession that comes from the apostles through the bishops down to our own time. And then there's a kind of the spiritual apostolic succession that comes from the prophets and the masters of prayer down to our own time through the elders and saints of the church. And that there's a current, the underlying current it's the current of prayer. Both of those traditions, both of those successions have never been lost in the Orthodox tradition. And so contemplation is really the fruit of prayer. It's supposed to be the fruit of prayer. You are praying so that you can contemplate. The word theoria really means seeing. It means divine vision. It means seeing. Ultimately, what does it mean? It means seeing God. It means seeing God's... If we don't see God through his face, we see his footprints. If we don't see his footprints, we see his articles, which are written in the natural, in the words and sentences and paragraphs of the natural world, right? But eventually, we come to see God. Contemplation means seeing. And there is no seeing without the practice that will lead to the purging of our soul of the passions and becoming closer and closer to the dispassionate, the non-passionate state. And that's why they say, don't try to contemplate before you have at least struggled with your passions. Because why? Because you desire to know God, and that's genuine. I mean, that's wonderful. It's wonderful to have that desire. If you do that, you are opening yourselves up to illusion. And so much of what is called contemplation and contemplative prayer outside of this tradition is in fact fantasia, imagination, or fantasy. And the reason it's fantasy is because the interior struggle, the ascesis, of which is fundamental to every Christian, and which monasticism is in a way the clearest model. It's the model for all of the church of how to live an ascetic life. But that ascesis has to be at the heart of it. Now let me read you two references that illustrate my point. And first, I will read from St. Isaac of Nineveh, this is the book called An Ascetic Life. It's only the first six homilies of St. Isaac. I would have rather have used the big book, which has all the homilies, but it was just too big to take. So this translation is there. And first he begins with a definition of contemplation. Contemplation is the perception of the divine mysteries hidden in the things which are spoken of. And then he goes on to describe what I'm talking about why it's so important to engage in the struggle with the passions, engage in unseen warfare with your passions, which is, as we saw, much more on the level of thought and feeling than it is then on the level of action. We are interiorizing the battle. Because ultimately, the battle for true prayer and contemplation is an interior battle. It's not an exterior one. So he goes on. When you hear about renunciation of the world, or about abandonment of the world, or about being pure of the world, first of all, you need to know and learn, not approximately, but with powers of discernment, step 27, what the term world means and how many distinctions this term consists. Only then will you be able to know your soul, how much you are distant from or connected to the world. If one first does not know what the world is, one will not understand how many parts of the body one is distant from or ensnared within it. Many of those who withhold themselves from the world in two or three respects think that their souls are particularly separated from it by their way of life. This is because they have not understood or perceived wisely that in one or two parts they may be dead to the world, while in all the other parts they are alive within the body of the world. Therefore, they are not even able to perceive their passions. And because they do not perceive them, they are not even concerned about their healings. According to contemplative examination, world is said to be in a general word which refers to distinct passions. When we want to speak of passions in general, we call them world. But when we speak of particular passions, we use their distinctive names. The passions are part of the ongoing course of the world. And where the passions have ceased, there the world has ceased proceeding on its course. We change the world by changing our passions. The passions are love of riches, amassing of possessions, the fattening of the body, from which proceeds carnal desire, love of honors, which is the source of envy, administration of government, pride and pomp of power, elegance, popularity, fear for the body. When those passions desist from their course, then correlatively, the world ceases to exist. In short, the world is a carnal way of life and the mind of the flesh. This is that negation of the world becomes when it becomes apparent in these two changes, by a transformation in a way of life and by a difference in mental impulses. You may take the measure of your way of life by observing your mental impulses and the things toward which your mind wanders with its impulses, namely, for which things nature longs willingly, both those impulses that are habitual and those that are set in motion for change, for chance. Whether the mind receives perception of incorporeal images only or moves wholly through matter, whether this materiality is passional or a question of the imprint of corporeal practice of virtue. whether the mind is not distressed by the hidden attacks of the imprints of thoughts because of its excessive reliance upon God, which keeps cutting off their memories. And that's talking about the other side of it.